KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, lawyer and longtime CNN and New Yorker Supreme Court analyst Jeffrey Toobin will join us in the studio. We'll talk with Toobin about the political battle over Justice Antonin Scalia's replacement, as well as big cases now pending and recently decided by the court. We'll also discuss Toobin's 1997 book about the O.J. Simpson trial, which is the basis of a hit miniseries currently airing on FX. Forum is next. After this, from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We're joined in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour by veteran legal affairs and Supreme Court analyst Jeffrey Toobin, who can be regularly seen on CNN and read in The New Yorker. He joins us to discuss the High Court without Antonin Scalia, as well as present and pending cases. And we also want to speak with him in this hour about his 1997 book about the O.J. Simpson trial, which is the basis of a series currently airing on FX. And we welcome Jeffrey Toobin back to the Forum program. Good to have you, Jeff.
Hi, Michael.
Well, let's begin by talking about what's going to happen to this court with a standoff going on between Obama and the Senate. It looks like we might have 4-4 votes for the next year or so. But the fact of the matter is that I was just reading in Politico that they're saying the court's going to lean left without Scalia.
I think that's right. I was in court last week during the argument of the big abortion case, and it was striking to me how much the court has already changed. Justice Scalia, in addition to being a dominant physical presence and verbal presence, was a key conservative vote, and the court is now has a very clear four-justice liberal tie. That can tie any case. So basically, the liberals are riding high. And you saw that in the argument of the abortion case, basically saying the worst that can happen to us now is we will affirm some lower court decisions we don't like, but that have no precedential effect for the whole country. And if we can peel off Justice Kennedy in certain circumstances, we'll have a substantial majority. So the court is already dramatically different. And I think the liberals are thinking that either President Obama will get someone through, although I think that's very unlikely, but that Hillary Clinton is the likely next president of the United States, in which case they probably will get a fifth vote, which will change the court.
Could be President Obama, in fact.
It could be. You know, I interviewed President Obama about the court, I guess it was about 2 years ago, and I asked him about that, whether he would like to serve as a justice in the mold of William Howard Taft, who became a Supreme Court justice after he was president. And the president deferred. I think he's looking forward to a little more active retirement and not one that as pressured. And I think he's not looking for that sort of fight or that sort of job. But you could tell the thought had occurred to him, though I think he is not going to be interested and he will not be nominated.
I want to talk to you about cases. You mentioned the abortion case. Actually, there was one in Louisiana as well as one in Texas. But I want to also get your read on a few things related to Scalia. One of the things that's come up now that I think is important, particularly for listeners to think about, and probably your readers as well, he was on a junket. Supreme Court justices are supposed to go on junkets without any kind of, with total impunity. They're also talking about a pillow over his head and all kinds of crackpot theories, but just the idea that they get these boondoggles. Yeah.
Well, this one I don't really think you could call a junket necessarily. I mean, he was with a group of friends, and this was not an organized meeting of a political group. This was not the Federalist Society. This was not some conservative organization. It was a hunting society where he went down with a friend, and the host hosted everybody for free.
So it was a paid-for trip, basically.
It was a paid-for trip, but by friends. I have to say, I disagree passionately with a lot of Supreme Court opinions. I don't have a big problem with the ethics of the justices. I think they do a lot of public speaking, all of them, mostly at law schools and bar associations. And I think we should encourage that, not discourage it. And those are all trips that are paid for, that the law schools, the bar associations pay for justices to come speak. And I think to the extent we can make them more public figures, less mystified, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So I don't have a big grievance with their junketeering.
Can you tell me why you compare Scalia to Nick Haraway?
Well, it was not so much this was a comment I wrote for The New Yorker where the point I was making was that
I should just mention that's the narrator in The Great Gatsby.
That Justice Scalia, if you look at his views, they were all backward-looking to a certain extent, most famously in terms of what he called originalism, the view that the Constitution should be interpreted in light of the meaning of the words at the time of the passage of the Bill of Rights in the late 18th century. So the justices were not thinking about gay rights. I mean, the framers were not thinking about gay rights. They were not thinking about women's rights. So the Constitution should not reflect any sort of recognition for gay rights or women's rights. And that, to me, was fundamentally a backward-looking philosophy. And there are particularly the way Nick Haraway looks at the world in Gatsby, he wanted everything to be as it was. And he wanted to look back to a better time as he perceived it. And I think the greatest Supreme Court justices look forward, not back. So that was the comparison I was trying to draw.
Talking with Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker, and I'm interested in just for a moment thinking about Scalia's so-called legacy, which I said we've spent some time talking about on Forum. But mm-hmm. when you think about Roe versus Wade still in place, when you think about Obamacare, when you think about gay rights and everything, his motivation to kind of keep us backward. The Onion had a headline, in fact, that said Justice Scalia dies following 30-year battle against social progress, didn't really hold. It didn't come through.
Well, when you consider how there has been a conservative majority at the court basically the entire time I have been following the court since the 80s, the lack of progress on many issues is striking. You know, Roe v. Wade does stand. Their affirmative action is still allowed. Now, I think when you also consider Citizens United and all the cases that are essentially deregulating American politics, when you look at how the Voting Rights Act has been crippled by the Supreme Court, it's not like the conservatives have lost all the time. But when you think about the big conservative projects of the past generation or so, overturning Roe versus Wade, ending any sort of racial preferences, they've come close to winning several times, but they have not won.
And we're going to now hear Clarence Thomas talk, actually.
Well, I think, you know, it is not a coincidence that he asked his first questions after Justice Scalia left, because there was such a void at oral argument with his absence. Again, you have four justices on the liberal side, Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, who all ask a lot of questions and are big presences in oral argument. The Chief Justice, who is conservative, you know, is not always that aggressive. Justice Kennedy has quirky views and sometimes is a quirky presence at oral argument. Justice Alito is very conservative, is, I think, a excellent questioner and very ideologically oriented, but doesn't ask a lot of questions. So just in terms of the number of questions being asked and the push that the advocates feel during oral argument, it's mostly coming from the left now. And I think Justice Thomas didn't, you know, who is, of course, very conservative, you know, wanted to lend his voice to the more conservative side. So I expect he's not going to become a chatterbox, but it's not going to be 10 years till he speaks again either.
Can you talk about what might be the White House strategy in naming a successor? Any insight about chances of even having a hearing? I know, for example, if there's been a lot of talk about Sri Srivastava, 97-0 agreed by a federal court. They put his name forward. He's a man of color, and you've got four, six races going on that are kind of up in the air?
The Senate races. Yes. I think, you know, the people in the White House I'd spoken to said they believe that the best policy is the best politics, which is put up someone of unassailable qualifications. I think President Obama, in the best sense, is a snob about the Supreme Court. He is not going to put someone up as a political gesture. He is going to put up someone whose qualifications are impeccable. And I think when you look at Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, both of them, you know, fit that mold. I do think that they recognize that this is a deeply political undertaking, and that's why I think the odds are that there will be a highly qualified person of color or a woman or both who will be nominated, who will offer a political benefit to the Democrats as they campaign over these next few years. But above all, the president is going to nominate someone that he wants to see on the Supreme Court. And, you know, it could be one scenario is that the Republicans decide during the lame duck period after the election, let's say Hillary Clinton wins, that this person is better than whoever Hillary Clinton is probably going to nominate. So someone gets confirmed then. Alternatively, Hillary Clinton will be spending the next several months saying how wonderful this person is. This person might get renominated by Hillary Clinton. So this person, though very unlikely to be confirmed during the, you know, the before the presidential election, may yet wind up on the Supreme Court.
Again, we're talking to Jeffrey Toobin. Let me go to some of the cases with you, and let's get close to home first, this teachers union case, because in some respects, this maintains the status quo. This is a huge victory for unions, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, as we look forward towards the Supreme Court's future in the next year, at least, the real question you have to ask is, what was the lower court decision? Because what happens under the rules of the court is if the court splits 4-4, it's called affirmed by an equally divided court. They don't write an opinion. They simply affirm the lower court's opinion, which applies only in the circuit, the group of states where the case takes place. In the union case, which comes here out of California, which is part of the Ninth Circuit, the union won. If there is a 4-4 tie, as seems very likely in that case, the union rights will be maintained until the court takes another case and actually reaches a decision.
You mentioned the Texas abortion case, and also I was thinking about the fact that in Louisiana they delayed force all but one abortion clinic to close. So these are significant decisions and may indeed suggest what we were intimating before about the court on 4-4 moving in a direction that was not anticipated.
But it's a different scenario in the Texas case because the lower court decision in the Texas case—
I was just going to get to that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No,
well,
go ahead.
Well, that affirmed the new restrictions in Texas. So a 4-4 ruling would be a loss for abortion rights, a victory for abortion restrictions. They need Kennedy's vote to overturn that. Having been at the oral argument, I think it is entirely possible they will get Kennedy's vote. The question is, under the court's rubric for abortion now, is are the new rules an undue burden on a woman's right to choose abortion? And when you look at how many clinics will close as a result of these Texas rules, it certainly seemed like Justice Kennedy was thinking this could be an undue burden. He was also considering, and this is something to keep in mind, that there might be a procedural out on the case to send it back for further fact-finding, basically to kick the can down the road with the abortion clinics open, I think, until the court has 9 justices. So that was a possibility that Kennedy raised that I think in an opinion might come up.
Justice Kennedy always seems to be kind of the wild card in all this, doesn't he?
You know, Justice Kennedy is he is mostly conservative. I think it's important he's not a moderate in the Sandra Day O'Connor mold, who really was someone who tried to steer a middle course. Justice Kennedy is a man of eccentric enthusiasms that are not completely consistent along the ideological lines that we usually think of. He is, of course, the author of all the Supreme Court's gay rights opinions. He has been a stalwart on that. He is also the author of Citizens United, which is a dramatic departure in the court's jurisprudence about campaign finance, both of which are rather extreme opinions but point in different directions. On abortion, he has been quirky. In the Casey decision in 92, he upheld Roe versus Wade, but in subsequent decisions on so-called late-term abortion, he's been very supportive of the anti-abortion position. So,
don't you think also...
Go figure
is right. When we talk about the Supreme Court and decisions, we also have to bear in mind the fact that Dow Chemical decided to settle a nearly $1 billion antitrust judgment just so they could avoid this 4-4 court, right?
Well, and you know, it just shows the hydraulic effect of membership on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's power doesn't just come from decisions they render. It comes from their effect on other people's behavior simply by the splits that exist on the court. And there are, you know, there was a long history in the 80s and 90s of civil rights communities sometimes paying substantial amounts of money to settle cases so the Supreme Court wouldn't get them. Now you may have a reverse situation where big corporations want to settle cases so the justices don't make law that the corporations don't like.
I'd like to also get your thoughts about this. Is a case that was tied initially to Salt Lake City and is tied to Ferguson in many respects. I'm talking about whether to give police more leeway to stop and question people in high crime areas. There was an ideological split there, naturally, as you could predict. What did we learn from that?
Well, you know, the criminal law generally, search and seizure law, Fourth Amendment, is probably one of the most active parts of the court's docket. There are always cases about can you search this car? Can you search the trunk? Can you follow? Can you attach a GPS device to a car? And those do tend to split along ideological lines as well, that the conservative majority tends to support the right of the police to do more. Again, it just depends on what, who's on the court.
Is this I want to get into, we said we talk about O.J., and I do want to talk about O.J. with you, although I was remembering the fact that when the murders took place and the whole brouhaha was going on and the trial was underway, we made a decision at that time to talk about domestic violence and not to talk about the trial. There was a radio station here in San Francisco that was following the trial 24 hours. You know,
I remember.
I mean, that's how big things were along those lines. But I want to ask you first about another case. It was a reversal of a decision of the Alabama Supreme Court. I think it's pretty significant. I'm talking about actually it began in Georgia, but this is a lesbian adoption case. It is pretty significant.
Well, the case, I think it's doubly significant because it was 9-0. And it was basically about, in simple terms, whether the Alabama courts had to honor a same-sex marriage in a different that took place in a different state, which is, of course, very important because Americans move. And they a same-sex couple in Massachusetts moves to Alabama. They decide to get divorced. Who gets custody of the kids? The question is, would the Alabama court recognize the same-sex marriage? I forgot, actually, what state the couple was married in. And the court, 9-0, without even hearing argument, was it Georgia?
Yeah, it was Georgia.
Said they have to honor the marriage. And Alabama's Supreme Court has been probably the most anti-gay court in the nation. And even the conservatives recognize there's a provision of the Constitution called the Full Faith and Credit Clause that even if you don't like same-sex marriage, these same-sex couples, they are as married as anyone else, and they're married in all 50 states, and you have to honor that marriage if you are in that state. And so I think it was a pretty easy case, is indicative by the 9-0, but I think it was a very important statement by the court to the more conservative courts that don't try to wage rear guard actions against same-sex marriage when it comes to dissolution or child custody. You gotta treat these people as married.
Again, our guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's here with us in studio, and he's also, in addition to writing for The New Yorker and being a CNN legal analyst, is the author of The Run of His Life about the O.J. Simpson trial, which is now on FX. It's the basis of a series that's airing now. And in fact, he also has a forthcoming book, which we should mention, called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst, which will be out in August. You've gotten a lot of publicity. I mean, it's a series that's very popular, but in addition to that knife being found, what do you make of that?
Well, I guess the one thing I want to make clear on behalf of all my friends at FX is they didn't stage this, because it certainly did give it certainly gave the series, which is doing great, even more publicity. What I make of it is I think it's very unlikely to be the knife used in the murders. When you look at,
we should mention it was a knife found at the Brentwood home. That it,
yes, supposedly. I mean, you remember that the as the lawyers say, the chain of custody is murky, to put it mildly. That supposedly a worker who was working on the when they were taking down O.J. Simpson's former house in 1998 found it on the premises, gave it to some cop he found on a nearby movie set, and the cop unaccountably held onto it for 20 years and just turned it over to the LAPD. So the LAPD, I think appropriately, is doing tests to see if there's any DNA or any sort of forensic evidence.
But they can't try him again anyway.
Right. I mean, this is all purely historical interest. But because of the double jeopardy clause, he could not be tried again. But obviously, you know, it's a very interesting, historical subject by this point. So, but just given the passage of time, it seems unlikely to me. And given, frankly, the fishiness of the whole story, I don't count on this as being.
You're sure about those FX executives not having any?
I really trust these folks. I really don't think it was them.
Well, you know, the trial's been analyzed and reanalyzed, and you were responsible in many ways for bringing Mark Furman's racism to light. And the fact of the matter is, race became more of an issue in some respects, didn't it, when you look back at it retrospectively in that case, than perhaps even guilt or innocence?
Well, I that's why I think the series is resonating so much today. You know, who would know that this series would be coming out as in the post-Ferguson era, Chicago, South Carolina?
It was supposed to be the post-racial era, right?
Right. Yeah. Not so much, right? And you know, this is and it's very much the take of the miniseries that this is a story about African Americans in the criminal justice system and what jurors and what defendants expect when they are dealing with the police. And I think the subsequent two decades have taught us that this is a subject that has not gone away. And that's really one of the many reasons, other than the great performances and the great writing, that the series is finding such a big audience.
Well, we have a big audience out there, and I know many of them want to talk to you, because we are talking about the Supreme Court. We're also talking about the O.J. Simpson trial, and you may want to join us on either of those subjects. You are certainly cordially invited to do that. We welcome your phone calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue with Jeffrey Toobin and your involvement in the program. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Jeffrey Toobin, a New Yorker writer and CNN legal analyst and author of The Run of His Life about the O.J. Simpson trial, which is the basis of an FX series that's airing now. He's also got a forthcoming book on Patty Hearst, and he'll be at City Arts and Lectures this evening in conversation with Jane Mayer at 7:30. And Jane Mayer will be in conversation with us in the next hour. Doing well by the New Yorker, as
that's,
I said to Jeff before we came on the air.
We are institutionally grateful to you, Mike.
I would hope so. In the meantime, we're going to go to our callers and emailers, but just on that FX series, we should make note of the fact, because I was struck by this, that Cuba Gooding Jr., who plays the lead role of O.J. Simpson, was sobbing playing that role. I mean, I know he's an emotional guy, but he got so into the role and obviously felt the identification, again, on a racial level.
Well, and one of the things about Cuba's performance that I think is so wonderful is that he has to make you understand, at the same time, this is a person capable of a horrendous pair of murders, and also someone who inspired such love and loyalty among a significant group of friends. So he can't be purely a villain. He can't be purely a good person. And
he was outwardly a kind of charming, charismatic guy. But
O.J. Simpson was absolutely.
Yeah, was a monster but in there
was
though,
a dark. Yeah. There was a very dark heart, but was not was often not visible except to the people who, or perhaps just to Nicole Brown, his wife and then ex-wife. And Cuba is an emotional person. You know, the moment in the case that I in the taping that I will remember with Cuba is that episode 5, which was last week, was directed by John Singleton, the great director, whose breakthrough film was Boys in the Hood, starring a very young Cuba Gooding. John starts directing Cuba for the first time on the set, just in, you know, normal every directions, and Cuba breaks down in tears because he remembers that John and he worked together at the beginning of their career, and basically they both became stars at the same time. And the emotion of being directed by John Singleton again was sort of overwhelming to Cuba. And I just thought it was an interesting insight into how actors and directors actually live
they bond.
As human beings, and they bond, and that you know it meant so much to both of them. And they're sitting there on the set. It was the courtroom set, which is incredibly realistic. And they're sitting there weeping, having nothing to do with O.J. Simpson.
You are convinced of O.J. Simpson's guilt. What do you say to someone who would say to you, "I'm not convinced, and I don't believe it," and he got off because there wasn't incontrovertible proof, and perhaps he still should be seen as not guilty?
Well, one of the things I have learned in—
Despite the civil case, excuse me.
Right, 2 decades of talking about this subject, it is like trying to persuade people that their religion is wrong. You just don't convert. You don't convince people. When you look at the forensic evidence, when you look at the blood trail of size 11 shoes walking away from the scene with O.J. Simpson's blood found to the left of the footprints, and you see that O.J. Simpson the next morning is found with a big bandage on his left hand. When you look at his blood on the gate, when you look at his blood in the Bronco, when you look at his blood back at his own house, and the glove found behind his behind Cato Kalin's window with the blood of the two victims on it, our prisons are full of people who were convicted on far less evidence than this. But if people don't want to believe he's guilty, I'm not arguing with anybody after all this time.
I'm looking at a comment here from Pete who writes, "I was once bewildered by the jubilant reaction at Howard University to the O.J. verdict. Now I have a much keener perspective for the plight of blacks versus the police."
Well, you know, and this is something that was why the case took on such a big resonance, because it was an example of how alienated African Americans felt from the criminal justice system, and in Los Angeles,
how racist
in particular,
they felt the police were.
Exactly, and that was a tremendous education for white America.
But O.J. really didn't even want to be seen in a racial context. That's a real irony.
This is why you know you can't make this stuff up. That out of all the people in the world who turns out to be the unjust beneficiary of the very true malevolence of certain police officers, it turns out to be O.J. Simpson, who had done everything in his life to avoid being seen as a representative of African-American struggle, but someone who really tried to avoid that world altogether. But, you know, real life is messy.
We are going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here, talking with Jeffrey Toobin. There was a piece in the Huntington Post where you were asked what question you would ask O.J. if you had the opportunity to. And the question which probably a lot of people want to ask is why? I always wondered, though, maybe Al Collins has the answer to that, you know, but I also often wondered, he was separated, his wife and he were fighting, he was domestically abusing her and so forth. Do you think that he thought, whether it was true or not, he thought that Ron Goldman was involved with his wife?
I don't think so, because just of the timing of how the incident took place. What I believe happened, and again, there were no eyewitnesses to the murder itself, O.J., they had quarreled earlier in the afternoon at their daughter's dance recital. He came over there in the evening full of rage. He goes through the house, chases her into the front yard where he kills her in this very confined space. Ron Goldman arrives just at that moment and he's set upon, mostly, I think, because O.J. recognized he didn't want to have a witness.
He didn't want a witness.
Right. So I do think that Ron Goldman was going over there for a tryst. If you look at the candles around the bathtub, if you look at sort of the circumstances, but I don't think O.J. Simpson knew that or had any way of knowing that. I think he was killed because he was a witness, not because he was a boyfriend.
We're going to go to your calls. And by the way, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We're talking also about the Supreme Court. And first caller on that subject, Alan, you're on.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Question about the Supreme Court right now. You know, just hearing how the Republican senators are refusing to even consider nominations, this seems blatantly illegal. And I'm wondering, is it illegal? And is there a cost to this? I mean, they're there to keep the wheels running, and this is the will, I'm assuming, not only of the people but of the Constitution. What's going to come of all this? What can we do to change this situation?
Well, I think, as with most things in the Supreme Court, it's a political issue. It's not a legal issue. The Constitution says the president shall nominate someone with the advice and consent of the Senate. The Senate certainly has the right to vote whoever the president nominates down. There is no time requirement on when they must act, but the only check on the Republicans' power here will be if vulnerable Republican senators, the senators who are up for re-election in 2016, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, go to Mitch McConnell, who was the Senate Republican leader, and Chuck Grassley, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, saying, we are getting the hell beaten out of us. We are worried about losing our seats because we are treating this nominee unfairly. Hold hearings, hold a vote. That's the check on the Republicans. It's a political check. It's not a legal check. You can't go to court and demand that the Republicans hold a vote on this nominee. The only check here is political. And based on what we've seen so far, the Republicans seem determined to brazen this out. They are not going to respond to political pressure and hold hearings or hold a vote.
Alan, let me thank you for the call. I want to go right to another caller, and let me go to Richard next. Richard, join us. You're on forum.
Yes, thank you. You know, you mentioned the Dow Chemical settlement. The Supreme Court vacancy, this is huge, huge stakes for consumers, because this court ruled that you don't even get your day in court if you have a dispute with a business, a case called AT&T versus Concepcion. And the Dow Chemical case, they settled a $1 billion judgment for $800 million, knowing they didn't have Scalia there to bail them out. So the courts matter so much for everyday people, whether we get access when we are in a dispute with big business. And that's a huge part of this. I hope it gets more.
Yeah, your point well taken, Richard.
I think Richard's point is really an important one, and I think I'm probably as guilty as anyone, because when I talk about the court publicly, I'm almost always talking about gay rights or women's rights or abortion or campaign finance. But in fact, many of the cases they deal with involve business and particularly civil lawsuits. The opportunity of individuals to seek redress for whether it's a consumer, some sort of consumer violation. And even you talked earlier about how the conservatives have not really won on the big issues. They've won on a lot of these corporate issues. You know, the limitation on going to court against corporations, whether it's the restrictions of class actions, whether it's what cases can be heard, whether it's suing on what are called form contracts. That you like your credit card bill or your telephone bill, those are areas that have been deeply the court has been very favorable towards defendants, towards corporations. And if a fifth vote comes from the Democratic side, that could change, and that would be very significant.
We had Ted Olson and David Boies on when their book came out about the fight for gay rights,
right.
And They promised that they would come on and talk about Citizens United, a different point of view. I mean, Ted Olson, pretty brilliant guy, and this is not a view that you often hear out here on the left coast.
Right.
I mean,
essentially, well, and defending he argued the decision. Citizens United, yeah.
Well, that's right. He, in fact, made that very clear. Somebody had sent in an email, and we went there, and I said, will you guys come back? And they said, yes, we'd like to do that. My question to you is, a lot of talk about getting rid of Citizens United congressionally or in other ways. Any crystal ball gazing on that?
I think it's certainly not going to be by amending the Constitution. Fortunately, it's very difficult to amend the Constitution. I think the way the court works is that when a majority becomes skeptical of a prior precedent, they don't immediately overrule that precedent, but they chip away at it. And I do believe if there is a fifth Democratic vote, you will see the court more and more uphold rules that limit campaign spending, that limit or that require disclosure. Remember also, though, that the Supreme Court doesn't make rules. They only issue thumbs up or thumbs down to rules that already exist. And Congress, at least, for the foreseeable future, with the House and the Senate in Republican hands, they're not going to be passing new campaign restrictions, new campaign finance laws anytime soon. So, you know, I wouldn't have people get their hopes up for dramatic change, but certainly the momentum would shift dramatically towards allowing restrictions on campaign spending. And when you talk to Jane Mayer next hour, how significant those issues are.
I'm going to go in the meantime to a listener comment. This is from Chris, who's writing about justice diversity, and he says, I don't like identity politics, which are so dominant these days, but on a body like this, it should not be all white men. Since Reagan appointed the first woman, the Republicans' next six choices have all been men, 5 whites and 1 black, 5 Catholics and 1 Protestant, whereas the Democrats have named 3 women and 1 man since that time, 3 Jews and a Puerto Rican New Yorker. While I'm at it, 4 judges are from different boroughs in New York City. Well, 3 now. And there are 4 Roman Catholics and 4 Jews and no Protestants.
It's really kind of remarkable. There are no Protestants on the court. I'm impressed that the speaker, one of my, you know, laugh lines has always been when I talk about the court that, you know, you had 4 boroughs represented, but tragically Staten Island has been unrepresented on the Supreme Court. Diversity is a peculiar thing. You know, it used to be that the court was very again, one of the interesting things about the history of the court is the court reflects the politics of the time. It used to be that geographic diversity was very important, that there'd be a certain number of justices from the South and from the West. Now, that is not a very present concern. The fact that both, you know, Anthony Kennedy is from Sacramento, Stephen Breyer is from here in San Francisco. No, most people don't even know that, and they don't care. Religious used to be a big deal, but you know there have been very liberal Catholic justices, William Brennan, Sonia Sotomayor, and very conservative justices like Antonin Scalia. So religion matters less than it does, but. You know, there will never be a time, I think, when the court has no African Americans anymore. There will never be a time when there are all men on the court again. So, you know, I think diversity is a big deal. And every president that considers appointments to the Supreme Court, think about it. If I can just offer one correction, President George W. Bush did nominate a woman, Harriet Myers, but that nomination went up in smoke. So, it wasn't all men that they nominated.
I always remember when his father nominated Clarence Thomas to the bench and said, this is the most qualified man to sit on the Supreme Court in the whole of the United States.
It was a controversial assertion. But, you know, whatever you think of Justice Thomas, he's been a very significant intellectual force on that court.
I'm not trying to put him down.
Given how young he was at the time. But, you know, interesting, he's not that young anymore. Well, time passes.
Yeah, it happens to all of us, Jeffrey. Here's Brad, who tweets some pushback. He says, OJ was acquitted of murder, Tubin speculation, doesn't trump a jury's verdict, defendants have rights, undermined by your guest.
Yeah, you asked me my opinion about whether O.J. Simpson was guilty. My opinion is he's guilty, but it is an understatement to say I have no legal authority in this or any other area. This gentleman disagrees. That's why we're here. But I certainly understand that the jury's verdict was what it was, but it doesn't mean I have to agree with it.
We'll go to more calls. Let me go next to Dover, Kentucky. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was listening recently to someone who has written about Oliver Wendell Holmes and eugenics and the decision about sterilization, and that's still on the books. And it occurred to me that people seem to have such an opinion of the Supreme Court that it almost rules by some sort of divine judgment. And I wonder if you'd comment on that. And is it just a lack of education about, you know, some of the most horrendous rulings like Dred Scott and that eugenics issue?
Well, I'm very glad that you mentioned that book. That book is called Imbeciles by my friend Adam Cohn. It's a new book about the Buck case shortly after the turn of the last century, where Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote this woman was sterilized, and she sued for damages and she lost. And Oliver Wendell Holmes said in a very notorious sentence, three generations of imbeciles are enough. In justifying sterilization. I certainly have done my best in my career to try to demystify the court and persuade people that certainly their views are not divinely inspired and beyond criticism. You know, I think the most accurate thing you can say about the Supreme Court is it reflects the best and worst of our country, and that, you know, this was The Dred Scott case before the Civil War illustrated how powerful slavery was.
This is not a divine court in terms of, you know, like ex cathedra from the Pope or something like that. It makes mistakes.
It makes mistakes. And you know, they supported the internment of the Japanese during World War II.
Right.
And but they also led the way or participated in the desegregation of the United States in the Warren Court in the 50s and 60s, starting with Brown v. Board of Education and then all the cases that basically said we can't have segregation anymore in the United States. And
but that overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, which was, of course, a very different kind of case.
And a very different time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the court reflects with pretty good precision the American people, for better or worse.
It's an ongoing debate, Jeff, but lifetime appointments?
I think it's a terrible idea. The Supreme Court was created in the late 18th century when people were expected to live into their 50s, if they were lucky. And now, fortunately, we live in a time when the kind of people who are appointed in the Supreme Court can expect to serve for 30 years.
Can also just proportionally expect maybe to get dementia in that period of time.
That's right. I think 18-year term limits would be a great idea. Stephen Breyer of Lowell High School, I've interviewed him about this topic, and he has an interesting perspective. He says, I don't have any problem with mandatory retirement. I don't have any problem with term limits. But what you have to set up is a system whereby the Supreme Court is your last job. You don't want justices angling for something else.
Like
legislators do. So I think that's a perspective. Look, you'd have to amend the Constitution. It's not going to happen, but I think it's just not right that we have people who serve into their 80s because they want their replacement chosen by one president or another, or because they just don't want to leave and they like the job. I think, you know, 18 years would be plenty, but it ain't going to happen.
Let me go to more of your calls. Let's bring in a caller from Bolinas. Kent, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I'd like to return to the issue of Justice Scalia's judicial deportment. In the case of Sierra Club versus Cheney, Vice President Cheney and Justice Scalia quite famously went duck hunting together while the case against Vice President Cheney was pending before the Supreme Court and before its decision, before argument was heard and the decision was written. Justice Scalia refused to recuse himself from that case. I'm wondering, at the time of his death, when he was on this trip that was paid for by someone else, were the persons who paid for that trip parties in interest or owners of a party an interest in a case that had been recently pending before the court.
Yes, John Poindexter, who owned the farm and the hunting lodge, had a case, but it was over. I actually was a defender of Justice Scalia for his famous duck hunting trip. I wrote about it in The Oath. You know, I'm from a city. I'm not a hunter, and I always thought it was interesting that that famous duck hunting trip with the vice president. It rained so much that they couldn't hunt.
Listen, Scalia was lucky he didn't get shot.
That's right. It rained so much that even the ducks couldn't come out. And I thought ducks liked water. But anyway, the government, the federal government, is the defendant in a high majority of cases at the Supreme Court. And so if they were to recuse themselves in every case where they had some sort of relationship with the federal government, they're all appointed by presidents. They live in Washington. They have friendships. I just thought, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman – played poker with Supreme Court justices. You know, Supreme Court justices, they live in Washington. They know these people. I think the idea that they have to live hermetically sealed off lives is unfair to them. And I think when you think about Justice Scalia, what people were angry about was not that he went duck hunting and he didn't recuse himself. They were angry because they didn't like Justice Scalia's opinions. And mostly, and in significant part, I didn't like them either, but I didn't think it was because he was unethical. I just thought it was because he had a different political and legal philosophy than I did. And I think we have this tendency to turn political differences into ethics controversies that I think we ought to just talk about the merits of the cases. I didn't think Justice Scalia was an unethical person, an unethical justice. He just had a judicial philosophy that I didn't care for.
Do you know who did better at the poker playing between the justices and the president?
Well, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist famously had a poker game all the time. And Robert Bork, who was nominated to the Supreme Court, played in it for a while, but he dropped out because what Rehnquist wanted to do with this poker game was play poker, and that's it. He didn't want to talk about the court. He didn't want to talk about anything else. All he wanted to do was play poker, and Bork wasn't that interested in poker. So, you know, I think it's hard to think of how that would have any ethical dimension at all, just sitting around talking about the pots of each game.
You mentioned Bork. I want to get to some more listener comments, but it really changed and politicized the whole court appointment thing. I mean, it was in that way quantum.
Well, it was it was a huge turning point in the history of the court. The 1987 appointment of Robert Bork to replace Lewis Powell, and I think it had a huge impact on how confirmation hearings played out, because Robert Bork, I think to his credit, answered the senator's questions, explained his judicial philosophy, and in part lost 58-42 in the Senate because that philosophy was viewed as too extreme by a Democratic majority. As a result, we have had several decades of justices stonewalling the senators, basically not revealing much of anything at all about their judicial philosophies, and that.
What is it? I mean, when you think about it, in the grand scheme of things, justices can say anything they want and then go the other way, as many justices have. So the whole process seems to be kind of questionable or tenuous.
Well, and Senator Schumer, who has been very active in this, has basically said, I am now discounting the whole confirmation process. I am only going to vote for or against someone based on their prior record, because I think the process of the testimony in the meetings with the senators has become sort of a farce.
Here's a listener who said about justice nomination. Steve writes, could your guest talk a bit about strategies involved in putting nominees forward and having them rejected for the campaign's sake, and strategies in the opposite?
Well, I don't think President Obama is putting up someone who with the intention of the person being rejected. I think the president is going to try very hard to get this person confirmed. I think the White House believes that a good nominee will be good politics. But I also think they recognize that if an African American is walking through the an African American nominee is walking through the halls of the Senate, and the doors to the Republican senators' offices remain closed to them, and the senators refuse even to meet with the nominee. That's a picture that could redound politically to the benefit of the Democrats, and I don't think anyone is in denial about the political ramifications. But it's just another example of how the court, through the nomination process, the confirmation process, and the decisions itself, is a deeply political body, and I don't have any problem acknowledging that.
We've just got seconds left. Do you weigh in on whether Cruz has the opportunity to be president of the United States, given his Canadian birth?
You know, there was an article in the Harvard Law Review written by two recent solicitor generals, a Democrat and a Republican, who analyzed the history and said that they think he does have the right to be president, and I was persuasive to me.
Jeff, good to have you on. Appreciate your being with us. And again, you can see Jeffrey Toobin this evening with Jane Mayer, who's going to be joining us in the hour ahead, at City Arts and Lectures, 7:30 at the Norris Theater here in San Francisco. And the FX series is now airing, based on his book, The Run of His Life, and forthcoming book, American Heiress, all about Patty Hearst. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We invite you to continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Actually, Steve's at the helm here this morning. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Natalie Yemenijan. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadan. Senior editor Dan Zoll. Executive producer Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.